And welcome to tonight's 5x15, which we've co-curated with Kew and as ever supported by Rathbones. Thank you so much to both institutions. It's fantastic to be involved like this with a botanic gardens like Kew because we realize how many things we've learned in this series. This is the fourth that we've done. We've looked at the relationship of youth, of nature, and just a few days ago, we were very happy to have Amitav Ghosh with us in Kew, talking about his new book about opium called Smoke and Ashes. And he looks at the relationship between the opium poppy and colonialism and really tells the story about how the British Raj, the British government, the East India Company became the basic first biggest drug smugglers in the world. It's a heck of an eye-opener if you didn't manage to catch it. But tonight we're going to be zeroing in on the history of plants. I don't know about you, but I don't walk through a garden, or I didn't used to. I think I do now. And think about the history of the things that are growing there. What countries provided them for us? And again, when you look at the things that we take for granted in our life, like palm oil or flax or cotton, all sorts of things that have become the staples of our world, where did they originate from? How were they moved around the world? Were they, in fact, crops that have been exploited and put to grow in different places? Because quite honestly, the empires of the Dutch and the British, the Belgians, they were very rapacious, as we're all now learning. And what's brilliant about working with Kew is that they're really lifting the lid on what's in this amazing collection. And of course, like all things to do with colonialism, as you will hear tonight, it's full of contradictions because at the same time as we have destroyed ecosystems in parts of the world, we've also, the fact that the Kew has become the place that holds on to and takes care of these specimens is absolutely vital to our future. And also, it's given rise to the environment movement, which I think one of our speakers, Safnam, is going to talk about tonight. I couldn't be happier to have the three speakers we've got for you tonight. And as ever, simple setup, they're going to talk, make opening remarks for the next 20, 25 minutes. Then we're going to chat. And then over to you for your questions, and please put them in the chat because I think you'll have a lot. It really makes you think, this subject, about so many things. There are some wonderful books to buy, The New Empire World, Andrea's wonderful book, The Brother Gardeners, and the details of all those books, plus, of course, Andrea's wonderful Humboldt book, will be in the chat from our bookstore, Newham Books. So, with no more ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker. No stranger to us here at 5x15, the wonderful Andrea Wolfe, whose earliest book, well, earliest book that I know anyway, was called The Brother Gardeners, Empire and the Birth of an Obsession. Andrea got in quite a long time before everybody else. This book came out a while ago. Since then, she's written the magnificent biography of Alexander Humboldt called The Invention of Nature, which is a really fantastic book for any of you who are thinking about what to read next. I couldn't recommend it more highly. So, Andrea, wonderful. She's going to speak to us about Joseph Banks and how the Kew collection originally came into being. Over to you.
Thank you, Rosie. Let me just, am I there? Yes. So hello, everybody. Thank you so much to have me back at 5x15. It's always very nice to be here. And so I'm going to start because I'm the historian here. So I'll be focusing on the past rather than just the future. But I believe that history is not a pile of dusty old ideas. Quite the opposite. I think history kind of opens up something very important in our understanding of the present. But for now, I'll just provide a kind of brief historical overview. So I've written a couple of books in which botanical gardens play a role, and one of the books is, as Rosie mentioned, The Brother Gardeners. And it's a book about gardens, of course, but also about politics. And though politics and economics might not be the first thing that springs to mind when we think about gardens, plants and gardens actually are a window into a much wider world. And the person I want to talk about today is Joseph Banks, who was a wealthy landowner born in 1743. And as a young man, he joined Captain Cook on his Endeavour voyage in 1768. And they circumnavigated the world. So they sailed around the world for about 3 years. They returned to England with stories of danger and adventures and different cultures. But also, they came back with portfolios that were filled to the brim with pressed plants, 30,000 plant specimens, 3,600 species, of which 1,400 were new to British botanists. So quite a botanical haul they came back with. And over the next years, Joseph Banks turned London into the center of botany and scientific inquiry. He became the president of the Royal Society. He turned his house in Soho Square in London into an academy of natural history, where every scientist who came to London had to go and kind of visit him. And he also became the nominal director of Kew Gardens, which back then was King George III's royal garden. And over these years, Banks sent many, many plant collectors to distant countries, but he also asked army officers, missionaries, diplomats to send back plants and seeds to Kew. And under Banks' direction, Britain really became the kind of nexus of the scientific and economic exploration of the world's flora. And he convinced George III to turn Kew Gardens into the greatest botanical collection of the world. But Banks did not just collect for botanical completeness or beauty. He very much believed that botany could bring economic profit to a nation. And the first step for him in this project was really to, or in this endeavor, was really to turn Kew into a storehouse of the empire and into an engine of colonial growth. And what he said is, he said, Kew should become a great botanical exchange house for the empire. So it wasn't just silver and gold that fueled the empire, it was plants, cotton, tobacco, sugar, coffee, tea. All of these plants brought wealth to Europe. And the idea was to find potentially lucrative plants, to send them to Kew, test and propagate them, and then to send them to other colonies. So, for example, it was Banks' idea to bring tea plants from China to India to start a tea production there, a project that failed when he tried to do it. Or he asked some plant collectors to smuggle cotton seeds out of India to the West Indies. And he was obsessed with these ventures. He was obsessed with New Zealand flax, for example, which he had seen in New Zealand during the Endeavour voyage. He had seen how the Maoris used it to produce cloth. So it was his idea, Banks's idea, to bring them to Australia and then to start a linen production there. And incidentally, he was also one of the major players for the establishment of the penal colony in Australia, because he had seen Australia on his Endeavour voyage. They had called, after all, the first place of their landfall, the place of their first landfall, Botany Bay. So he had seen that this was a continent that was rich in plants and in soils. And when the botanical garden in Calcutta was established in 1787, Banks said that it should be solely used for the promotion of public utility, which basically meant economic growth. So he wanted it to be a nursery for cloves and nutmegs in order to destroy the Dutch spice monopoly. So you can see that one aspect of Kew's history as a botanical garden is really that it fueled the making of the British Empire with all its very problematic implications of exploitation. But, and I think that's an important part, that's obviously not its role today. Botanical gardens today focus on scientific research, biodiversity, conservation, and let's not forget the joy of nature. And there was just a report, a study last week, where it was revealed that botanical gardens are the most effective green space at cooling streets during a heat wave in cities. So I think that's it for me now, the kind of very, very, very quick and brief historical overview. And I'm looking forward to talking more about it later.
Andrea, thank you so much. That was really terrific. I mean, it is a very eye-opening discussion, this, that you start to see plants in a completely different way. And yes, you're absolutely right about the trees. And someone I know who's got a book coming out, talks about how they've really worked out how just being near plants completely affects your body's inflammation levels, the level of ability of your microbiome to function well. I mean, there's extraordinary medical science coming through about the benefits of this, which honestly we never ever knew. Anyway, I'll be back to you in a little while, but in the meantime, I'm absolutely thrilled to introduce our next speaker tonight, who is Satnam Sangera, who you will have possibly first known about because of The Boy and the Top Knot, The Boy with the Top Knot, and then, of course, his best-selling book, Empire Land, which was turned into a fantastic Channel 4 series. Now, his new book is Empire World, and I'm in the middle of it at the moment, and it's an incredible read with a great deal about plants and about, as Andrea left us on this point, of how they were such an economic power to the empire, which I think has been just so overlooked. So, Satnam, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and over to you.
It's my pleasure. To be honest, I never saw plants as part of the imperial story. When I started, writing, researching my book on the legacies of the British Empire around the globe, and looked at the other books that have been written on the subject by, say, Neil Ferguson and Jan Morris, plants barely get mentioned. And, the story that Andrea has just beautifully introduced to us, it's not really on the minds of imperial historians. And to be honest, I'd never really thought about plants. About empire through the prism of plants, because for me, plants are interior design, and gardens. But the thing that woke me up to the importance was going to Barbados and researching the story, the history of slavery there, and realizing that, sugar production was a botanic process, the taking of sugar to Barbados to produce it. That involved a lot of plants. And when the soil became eroded because of the over-cultivation of sugar, solving that problem, which at one point involved importing soil from another colony, that was also a botanic process. And then when there was cane disease and when sugar cane production suffered in the face of sugar beet production in Europe, the solution for that was also botanic. So that was what opened my mind up to the idea that plants might be really important. And I started reading books by Andrea, an amazing book, Brother Gardeners, but also books by Kate Telcher. And I went to Kew and I met Mark Nesbitt, and I went to the Department of Economic Botany and realized actually plants were at the cutting edge of British colonialism. I mean, just three plants to mention at the start. Cinchona, that's the plant that produces quinine. You've probably heard of quinine as being the ingredient in gin and tonic. That helps people survive malaria. And that was hugely important because before quinine came around, hardly any part of Africa was really colonized. And by the time it being grown on plantations and become industrially produced, it enabled European colonizers, including the British, to colonize large parts of Africa and Asia. So a tiny plant, the bark of a tree, enabling major colonization. Then you've got rubber. I actually didn't even know that rubber could be a plant. It can be a plant, and it's also not a plant nowadays. So that was a surprise. But the rubber that we produced in Malaya, in Singapore, in the Far East, created a major rubber industry. It became Singapore and Malaya, British Malaya, became hugely profitable for the British. So much so that the British fought one of the most vicious wars in the history of the empire, the so-called 1948 Malayan Emergency, to hold on to that colony. Some of the most brutal things that ever happened in the history of British Empire happened because of that plant. And then, of course, you've got tea. Tea led to war with China, the Opium Wars, as we tried to pay for it with opium. It played a role in the loss of the American colonies, the Boston Tea Party. We forget that the tea that was thrown into the harbor was East India Company tea. It led to the changing of the diet in India and in Britain. Indians barely drank tea in 1900. It was made into a national drink in India by the British, who made huge profits from the cultivation of tea. It arguably created modern marketing because tea was the first mass market international product, and that created the kind of marketing we're very used to now with Coca-Cola and so on. And it also led to massive labor exploitation across the empire, as we needed tens of thousands of workers to produce the tea. And people continue to be exploited in the same parts of the world that they were exploited in the 19th century, often in very similar ways. And then, of course, we've got stuff mentioned already: palm oil, garden plants, the rhododendrons, the azaleas. These plants that we see as innately British, actually coming from other parts of empire. But as Rosie pointed out, empire was highly contradictory. It led to democracy and geopolitical chaos. It led to slavery and anti-slavery, and it also led to massive environmental destruction, as we've just talked about, but also to the birth of environmentalism. So we had huge destruction caused by all these plants and all these plantations. Even today, there's landslides in Sri Lanka caused by tea plantations that the British established there. The soil erosion, the 60% of New Zealand's forests that were destroyed by the British. But this led to an anxiety amongst British imperialists about plants and led to the birth of modern day environmentalism. As far ago, as far off as 1847, there was the Bombay Forest Conservancy trying to save forests in Bombay. In 1858, there was a paper written by a British scientist where he talked about something that sounded distinctly like the greenhouse effect. And there were early soil preservation initiatives in places like St. Helena, which we also destroyed environmentally, as well as trying to save. So for me, plants epitomize the fundamentally contradictory nature of the British imperial mission. And I'm going to stop there and let someone else carry on.
Thank you so much. That was so full of different ideas and thoughts. And I suppose I was reminded as well when you mentioned the rubber in Malaya, and now they don't, in Malaysia, they don't grow that anymore. But you can drive now from Singapore more or less up to Kuala Lumpur, and you do not leave palm oil. And it's just acre after acre after acre of this single monocrop. So we're still doing a colonialism all the time now. And I think that's something we'll come on to discuss after we've listened to our third speaker tonight, who's the lovely Emma Nicholson from the who's head of art at the Royal Botanic Gardens up in Edinburgh. And Emma has been working on trying to fuse the ideas of art and nature to take environmental concerns and give them a much wider brief and make them more accessible to other people. So, Emma, I know you're going to show us a bunch of images of artists that you've been working with up in Edinburgh, and we're really looking forward to seeing them. So, over to you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here amongst you all this evening. What you see here is a tiny snapshot of the possibilities of the world that I work in at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. You can see an artist meeting and talking with one of the science team, exploring our incredible collections and spaces. You can see our library and archive, gardens and Inverleith House Gallery. They represent our past, present, and future. Established in 1670 in an era of plague and famine, the Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh aimed to provide medicinal plants for the well-being of the people of Edinburgh. And one of the ways that we work today is to bring together art, science, and horticulture to confront global challenges. I'm going to share with you some recent examples of how our arts program has generated greater links and understanding in the natural world while simultaneously addressing our colonial and imperial legacy, actively working towards inclusivity. Now, I'm just going to. Sorry, having a bit of. What?
Can you move on to a second slide?
I'm trying to do that, Rosie. It's oops, sorry, I don't want to do that. Don't know why it's not. Ah, there we go.
There you go.
Sorry about that.
Don't worry.
At the Botanics, we're involved in plant conservation efforts, safeguarding endangered species and preserving genetic diversity. Initiatives like this one, with the artists' collective cooking sections, Their salmon breeding forest demonstrates the potential of art to inform and inspire science. This groundbreaking study explored the intricate relationship between trees and salmon in Scotland, proposing a new conservation model called salmon breeding forest. Facing threats of deforestation, overfishing, and salmon farming leading to near extinction, this project emphasizes the vital role that trees play in providing fertile salmon breeding grounds. Inspired by fish breeding forests in 10th century Japan, the proposal by these artists envisions a shared future for trees and salmon. They collaborated with our ecologist, Chris Ellis, and their study traced marine nutrients in tree trunks in the Cairngorms, revealing the significant role of salmon in nourishing trees. This research, the first of its kind in the UK, sheds light on the interconnectedness of marine and terrestrial ecosystems, offering insights into sustainable conservation practices for Scotland's rivers and forests. This slide represents the work of Australian South Asian artist Keg D'Souza, whose exhibition Shipping Routes examined the historical and contemporary ramifications of the movement of plants such as the prickly pear and eucalyptus through empire. Her work, Blue Haze, delves into the profound repercussions of the colonial introduction of eucalyptus outside Australia. Following its journey from the British colonized Australia to India, we learn of the ecological and cultural upheaval caused by displacing these trees from their Aboriginal lands. The impact spans globally, causing water resource loss in South Africa, deforestation in Madagascar, and contributing to bushfires in California. Introduced into India under Western advice, the eucalyptus, initially promoted for economic benefits, resulted in severe ecological consequences, disrupting native ecosystems. Despite contemporary awareness of the drawbacks, the ecological impact of colonial decisions persists and echoing through the Indian landscape today. This slide is from our current exhibition, Silent Archive, and illustrates the work of Indian artist Sonia Mirachalwar. In the show, she mixes her own photography, film, and drawing with historical material from our archives to weave together the fascinating story of jute in India and its connection to Scotland. In particular, she highlights the contemporary role of women at work in the former Scottish-owned Hastings Jute Mill near Kolkata, Bengal. She shares the essence of these women, their toil, and the historical significance of jute production, connecting the contemporary labor narratives with colonial and post-colonial archives. My final slide illustrates the work of Shiraz Beju, also in the Silent Archive exhibition. Shiraz, originally from Mauritius, shares the story of his island. An island situated in the Western Indian Ocean that has a complex history shaped by European colonialism, particularly the French and British empires. When Shiraz and I first approached our archive about material relating to the island, they thought we had very little, which was true, but what we did have was significant, and it turned out to be very valuable, particularly to the garden in Mauritius. To bringing together significant items from our archive and contemporary photographs and historic prints, this work becomes a vehicle for understanding the movements of people brought to Mauritius through slavery and indentured labor and the role of plants at that time. In this slide, you see the Edinburgh-trained botanist James Duncan's catalogue of plants in the Royal Botanic Garden, Mauritius, from 1863. And as a result of this exhibition, we've been able to give them a copy of that book, which they didn't themselves have. Also viewed here is a photograph of a maroon cemetery, symbolic of the resistance to slavery on the island. The image is layered with botanical prints of plants identified for their economic value by 16th century Dutch colonizers. I see the artists presented here, the artists that I work with, as agents of change. As such, they're able to step across institutional boundaries and help us bring to the fore issues of identity, belonging, and the environment. And of course, these fascinating stories around plants.
Oh, thank you so much. That was really moving, especially that last slide, incredibly so. And made me think of so many things. And there's a wonderful bit in Suzanne Simard's book, Searching for the Mother Tree, about how the bears eat the salmon and bring them
Yes.
and drop the bones at the bottom of the trees, and how they find salmon oil in the you know what I mean, in the root systems, which is
Yes.
fantastic. So can we bring everybody in on their cameras now? And let's get a sort of general discussion going. Andrea, can you tell us a bit more about Joseph Banks? I mean, what did he want to get out of this? It's almost like he wanted to be king of the world.
Yeah, a little bit, I think. I mean, he was, in a way. I mean, he was the president of the Royal Society for so long. I mean, for decades. And he really ch so until then, the Royal Society had kind of focused. I mean, like, proper science was like physics, mathematics. So you have someone like Isaac Newton, for example, who was the president. And then this kind of botanist rocks up and changes the course of what is believed to be important. So botany really becomes a and horticulture becomes a very, very important science in Britain at that time. And it's, I mean, it I think it's also the really the beginning of Britain becoming this kind of gardening nation, which we know today. But for Banks, it was I think it was a it was I mean he was a very wealthy landowner, and he went on this voyage. And if you think about it, I mean, it was very I mean, dangerous and very uncomfortable. I mean, his cabin was the size of like a double bed today, and he kind of gave up his, comfortable life to do this. So there's definitely a kind of he was an adventurer, definitely. But when he comes back, and it's quite amazing if you look at his portraits from he was this incredibly handsome, dashing man, and then when he becomes older, he becomes incredibly fat and not that nice, not that good looking anymore. So he becomes this center. He's almost like a spider in a web, and this web that he just spreads it across the whole world. And he has so many projects. I mean, so I mentioned Australia beforehand, so he is the one who really discusses with the British government and the king that this, we've just lost America, why not have another penal colony? And then he goes and says, it's just great in terms of what there is in terms of botany. And he does things like, I mean, for example, the breadfruit tree. So he is the one who sends William Bligh, Captain William Bligh, with a bounty. And what he did is he had seen breadfruit trees on the Endeavour voyage in Tahiti, and he had seen these kind of big starchy kind of fruits which can be cooked and baked, and the trees have several harvests a year. It's one of the highest yielding food plants in the world. So his idea was, well, we can bring these from the East Indies, from the South Pacific Islands, to the West Indies, Jamaica, St. Vincent, to feed the slaves on the sugar plantation, because this would be very nutritious food.
So
So
sweet.
he equips, and then the bounty was like a floating greenhouse. Quite, I mean, they still have the ship plans in Greenwich at the National Maritime Museum, and you can see that the great cabin was turned into a greenhouse. They were like that. You can see all the little pots in there. Bligh was in a tiny little cabin next door, and many people argue that one of the reasons that there was this mutiny is because Bligh didn't have the great cabin, as which kind of exuded authority. So anyway, we all know that this venture didn't go quite according to plan. So the last thing that Bligh saw of his breadfruit trees were 1,015 of them all neatly planted up in his great cabin. Then he was cast into an open boat. He does actually manage to come back. And Banks and Bligh don't give up. So 4 years later, Bligh goes out again, and this time he succeeds. So he brings 600 thriving breadfruit trees to St. Vincent and Jamaica, where they, became actually the food of the slave population. So I think the reason the what kind of makes what makes Bank tick is that it's the power, definitely, but also just the this
I mean, it's patriotism. He really believes, Britain should be this kind of great empire, and he believes that Britain should break the Dutch spice monopoly. I mean, there was this, there was a very long kind of competition between the two countries. So it is really, with, as Satnam said earlier, botany. I mean, I've always looked at gardens as a kind of vehicle to understand much bigger issues, and botany is the engine of empire. I mean, one of the main engines of empire. So it's not, it's not about pretty plants and climbing roses in the lovely cottage garden. It is really about power and colonialism and exploitation, and all of that is also in our pretty plants.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. I mean, Satnam, you say, I think right at the beginning of your chapter about plants that, and I think I'm quoting here, that in the classic histories of the British Empire, there's really more than a few hundred words dedicated to plants and botany. But just listening, anyone listening for the last half hour would think this is such an extraordinary thing to have overlooked. Because Andrea says it is the economic and the engine of the idea that we took the food. I mean, now we'll do that through Nestle's or, Cargill or something, and you can, but it's like the predating of the vast food empires that we have today, and it's so manipulative.
If I could add one thing to the breadfruit story,
Please.
I might be wrong, but my understanding is that actually when it was breadfruit was finally introduced on slave plantations, the enslaved resisted it.
They didn't like it, yeah.
They didn't like it, they resisted it. And actually, breadfruit is now a national dish in Jamaica, which suggests, some academics argue, that the enslaved deliberately resisted it, which is a really important thing because we don't have a huge amount of evidence about how the enslaved reacted to these things. But it also shows that they had agency and volition, and often they resisted the plans of these clever imperialists. I mean, all this stuff is really interesting, and it's exciting as well because, it paints a whole new view of Kew Gardens and history. But I think it's really important to not get carried away because a lot of these discoveries by these very clever imperialists were just plagiarizing what the indigenous were doing anyway, So, for example, gutta-percha, one of the first plastics that was discovered that enabled communication, wrapping of wires, enabled communication between the world. An incredible thing you could say the Victorians discovered, but actually the Malayans were using it for centuries on their canes. Tea, we could say, oh, isn't it exciting and amazing that the British turned India into a tea drinking country? But actually, there were indigenous people drinking tea in India going back centuries. The same with rubber. It's great that we built these incredible plantations, but South Americans were using it in water bottles hundreds of years ago. The same with palm. I mean, the Africans were using it way before the West woke up to the benefits of palm oil. And quinine as well, the medical properties, they weren't a Western discovery. I mean, we don't know how or who the first people were who discovered the medical properties of quinine, but most likely it was indigenous people in South America. And what the imperialists did was take this stuff and industrialize the production. I think it's really important to remember that.
And I think this is so right, and I think this is still happening today. I mean, so much so, if you look at kind of medicinal plants, for example, big pharma who go in and who, it's not just the theft of the plants, but also of traditional knowledge. They go in, they kind of they get the traditional medicinal knowledge, then they kind of invent their medicine, patent it, and then that's basically theirs. I mean, it's not something that's in the past and kind of stopped at some stage. It still continues to the day.
Yes, but how would you? I mean, I know South American countries are trying to work out how they would maybe sell the things that we still have not discovered that are within, say, the Amazon rainforest. But do you think that that's actually something that could happen?
I don't know. I really don't know. I the end, I can, I mean, in that respect, I'm just a, the general public who thinks it's not, the appropriation of kind of sacred knowledge and sacred plants is, there is an issue which needs to be discussed, and indigenous people need to be involved in this discussion. It can't just be like big Western pharma coming in and taking what, what we need.
There's also
And
the,
Satnam, yeah, can
sorry.
you go on with what you were saying?
Yeah, there's also the way in which the British ended indigenous traditions of environmental custody. So in Australia in the late 18th century, for example, the British ended the indigenous tradition of controlled burning in South Australia. And guess what? That resulted in wildfires. The British also cut down oak forests in India, in the Western Himalayas, and they were resistant to wildfires, and they replaced them with flammable pine. And guess what happened? So there is that aspect of completely riding roughshod over centuries of indigenous knowledge, because they thought they knew what was best. And I'm afraid to say Kew Gardens was involved in some of that.
But in the way that Emma would want to bring you in here, that if you're a museum, and we were before we started talking a bit about the British Museum, I mean, you can argue and say that whether the Elgin Marbles should go back to Athens or something, you've got a sort of way of making a reparation. As a botanic garden, you do interesting kinds of reparations, don't you? You work in Malaysia, and I know that Kew work in Colombia, trying to be the preservers of things that otherwise might disappear.
Absolutely. I mean, I agree with everything that Andrea Satnam have just said, and lots of the artists that I work with have kind of been surfacing those stories, I guess. But my colleagues in science who are working with taxonomy and things like that, for example, you referenced Malaysia, there's a team out there at the moment who are working with local community groups and academics to identify particular strains of plants to help with the kind of reforestation of areas of Sarawak and Sabah. You touched on palm oil in that region, and that's a very complex topic because there's kind of good and bad stories there, and there are approaches to looking at kind of planting the understory around palms and more ethically produced palm oil. And so a lot of my colleagues are working in areas like that. I think we're working in around 35 countries around the world with people locally on the ground looking at conservation and sort of better practice, if you like.
Do please put in your questions to our three wonderful speakers, because we'll come to them in 5 minutes or so. But Sazlan, one of the points you make in your book is that the complexities, and empire is constantly full of contradictions, nowhere more so than in the plant world, and indeed in the sense that on some level it's also created the environment movement.
Yeah, but I don't think we could sit around going, great,
No.
we helped create the environment in modern environmentalism, so we don't need to think about what we did. As a country, we are very good at lecturing the world when it comes to conservation and the environment. There's very little reflection on what we did. The royal family especially, they like to opine on animal conservation in particular, and I've never heard them talk about the ivory in all the palaces, about all the animals on their walls. But at lower level, the National Trust is one of the most popular membership organizers in Britain, and we all love going to National Trust homes and cooing at the mahogany furniture of the like that you've got behind you, Rosie, possibly. But I've never heard it pointed out that mahogany was so popular that we nearly made mahogany forests extinct in the Caribbean, that we were so keen on ferns in the 19th century that it led to fern mania and the destruction of environments across the world, right? And so there's a disconnect between what we enjoy and what we lecture the world about and what we did. I would like to see leaders, when they lecture the world on these things, to talk about what happened during the British Empire, because even if we don't remember it, I think the world does.
Yes, I absolutely agree with you, and I do think that the whole question of plants now has become a very a kind of hot topic and something to which everyone can relate, and a sort of realization that if you're not privileged enough to live near green space, you have a worse quality of life. And but if we go back to say that the terrible destruction of teak or the destruction of hardwoods, do you think that people thought that there was a limitless supply. I have an incredible memory of sometime around about 1975, and the fisheries minister, whoever they were, saying the sea is an inexhaustible supply of fish. We do not need to worry about overfishing. And that's actually less than 50 years ago, that someone still believed that nature was the gift that kept on giving.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree.
Go on,
So
Andrew.
I so the my one argument against that would be there have been scientists, like Alexander von Humboldt, for example, who more than 200 years ago already warned about harmful human-induced climate change. So John Evelyn in the 17th century, he who was in charge of kind of shipbuilding, he wrote I think the only or one of the earliest bestseller on forestry in the 17th century, where he basically warned that if Britain would continue to build this many ships, they would destroy the whole of the entire forest of England in the 17th century. I think he wrote it in 1666 or something like that. So I think it is a matter of, do we want to listen or not? It's the same with climate change. I mean, this has been going on for many, many decades. Do we listen? No, we don't. And I think it's the same with, there will always be voices who say, nature will just be there and supply us. But the criticism has been there for a long, long time. And the
Yes,
warning.
I mean, it's good. It Satnam, do come in here. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my argument is also that, you can't be black and white about these things. And the complexity of imperialism is evident not only in Kew Gardens, but also in national parks. Very similar. Botanic gardens and national parks, very similar things. National parks were created by the British around the world. They opened them in Australia, New Zealand, and they seem like intrinsically good things, right? It was preserving the environment. Kew Gardens, it seems intrinsically good, but actually, national parks were often opened by British imperialists after they had damaged the environment, or they opened them so they could carry on the hunting the animals that they'd hunted to near extinction in the first place. And then nowadays, national parks, of course, don't allow the indigenous people born there to live their lives in the way they want to, which is a colonial attitude. So is it fair to say national parks are good, or are they bad? Is Kew Gardens good or bad? The only answer is they're both things. So to say that, Kew Gardens needs to hold his head in shame or national parks need to is ridiculous. It's like saying I want to study the environment, but I only want to concentrate on the rain. I want to study the climate, and I only want to study the rain or the sunshine. There's a lot of weather in between, and we need to talk about the complexity, and we also need to invite the world to engage in the conversation, because until now, for centuries, the conversation has been a monologue of the British people saying this is how it should be. We've been very, very bad at listening.
We've been extremely bad at listening, but I would also say that we're still extremely bad at listening. I mean, in the whether you look at climate change or I mean, I do a lot of food politics, so I look at the way we grow food and we continue to cut down the Amazon to produce for cattle or for soy or for whatever, for feed, to feed a kind of insatiable world, the diets. It's not completely dissimilar to the story of the breadfruit. If you look at how the Western companies took over the Chinese market for baby food, it was a deliberate act to give children something that was not as healthy and that made someone a great deal of money. And that's quite scary. Now, listen, we've got lots and lots of questions coming in. So let me start digging them out. How is Q? I'm not sure who to direct this to. Maybe Emma, you can pick this up on behalf of Q. How is Q addressing its colonial past, and how much is shared with the visitors at the moment? I mean, e.g., I know the National Trust is not, I mean, Satnam, you mentioned the National Trust. I mean, I know they're trying, but they're not being completely successful about telling the story of really where all the money for all those historic houses came from yet.
I think they're trying really hard, and they've faced massive resistance in form of right-wing pressure groups, right-wing press, huge culture war amongst politicians, and Kew Gardens has had some of that. And I think National Trust and Kew are doing the right thing, which is commissioning research and allowing academics and writers to do their work and giving them space to do the work. Because in the end, you can't argue with knowledge. You can't repress knowledge and understanding, no matter what you come up with in the newspapers.
Yeah,
Go on,
Sanam's right.
Andrea.
I think it's very much about opening the doors and inviting new voices in, whether that's artists or researchers from some of those geopolitical regions where we've got history and legacy. And that's something that we're doing in Edinburgh. And I know there are parallels in Kew. I don't really feel comfortable speaking for Kew.
Oh, okay. No worry. Andrea, when did botany become, this I think is a question directed at you, when did botany become lucrative? Because when you read about the characters in your book, they all seem to be kind of amateurs. I mean, what point did botany become a job and a science?
Well, I think botany became lucrative very, very early on. I'm like with the early explorers. I mean, they all brought back lucrative plants. I mean, potatoes, tomatoes, tobacco. I mean, all of that became very lucrative. So, if the question is more aimed at for the individual, it's the moment when it's not just the gentleman collector, like banks, for example, but when does it become a profession? I think that really happens more in the kind of early 19th century, late 18th century. So when banks send out these plant collectors, they obviously get paid. I mean, not very much, but they get paid to go, and travel to South Africa or so. But botany as a discipline, I mean, existed before, but I think basically the word scientist was coined in 1834. Before, we don't have the word scientist. And that's really the moment when the science has become more and more specialized, when you have scientists kind of, that's why they came up with the name, being paid for being a scientist rather than just being, a wealthy aristocrat. Does it become lucrative? I think it becomes really lucrative for nations. And then you have, and then you have someone, like the rubber industry, then it becomes incredibly lucrative. But it becomes lucrative for, do you count botany as lucrative as the sugar plantation? I would say yes, because that's a plant. So then, that's very early on. So
And actually, I would link to that. I would say, when did plants become very profitable for empire with sugar production? Because even at the time, there was a focus on the Americas, the American colonization, and later huge focus on India. But actually, Britain made a huge amount of money from sugar production. Even today, one of the richest MPs in our parliament is Richard Drax, whose family wealth comes from James Drax from sugar production, I think in the 16th century on Barbados. That's how much money they made. Even today, that wealth persists.
yeah, well, if you wanted to add one more thing to the Drax story, they're also behind the Drax Power Station, which is the main biomass burning hub in the whole of Europe. And it, in fact, emits much more carbon than any coal mine. And because the government made so many cock-ups about how they were subsidizing power and energy, they made this decision that the burning biomass was, in fact, an environmentally sustainable idea. But now there is absolute knowledge that they're taking new growth forests, old growth forests from British Columbia and the southern states of America, shipping it across the Atlantic, putting it in a power station in Yorkshire. And
I did not know that.
we
I
as
did
the
wonder
tax.
whether the Drax power stations were related to the family. I didn't
Yeah.
know that.
Anyway,
Fascinating.
it's an issue that a lot of people fight against because the subsidy situation is going to come up quite soon as to whether it gets renewed. So there's a sort of complicated question here for you, Satnav. Someone's written in to say it still feels like the big white Western man is wading in to help. Now, I mean, obviously, you're not the big white Western man, but there is obviously the case too that the environment movements or WWF or whatever these groups are people still riding much too much riding roughshod over the indigenous knowledge?
In general, this is a very good point because, the term white savior is considered a massive insult today, right? Bob Geldof
Yep.
was getting very upset 2 weeks ago when he was called a white savior because of Band-Aid and Live Aid. But actually, if you went to the 19th century and accused the imperialists involved in all the stuff we mentioned of being white saviors, they would say, take it as a compliment, you know, because that's literally what they thought they were doing. They were spreading white British values, you know, anti-slavery and anti-sati and anti-thugs and all this stuff they were doing to civilize India and in their terms. And so I don't think they would see it as an insult at all. And you know, there's various sectors that are more awake to this criticism than others. I think botany is just waking up to it, but the charity sector has had to really struggle with the notion of white saviorhood for a long time and has had probably done so more than any other sector. And you know what? They're doing really good work, which they would some people would call decolonization, but I would just call it being awake or
I
to
think,
sensitivities.
yeah,
yeah,
I think,
Emma.
yes, I just wanted to jump in quickly, and I just say to Satnam, your section on the charities in your book was totally illuminating for me. I hadn't thought about some of those charities in that way, but I wanted to say that, as botanics today, we are working around the world, and I hope in a very different way, with training experts in the field, and very much kind of forefronting the local knowledge and the local expertise. That is how organizations like Kew and Edinburgh Botanic Gardens work now, with local people. And we work with community groups, for example, with the Flora of Nepal, in helping them to identify plants that have got potential economic value, and that they may be therefore at risk of being, I suppose, stolen from the wild, and encouraging people to be more aware of the plants in their own area. And I hope that through our kind of exhibitions program and through the artists, we're also kind of enabling the general public to become more aware of these things, just as your kind of books, and that's really important. And that goes on to influencing policy and at an international and national level. No,
No,
just to bring it
that's a
back to the
great.
current a little
Yeah,
bit. Thank
no, I think that's a great way of explaining how botanic gardens can play a really big role. But I'm curious because one of your slides that you showed us of the artworks was about the eucalyptus tree, and
you.
I mean everyone kind of knows how much damage it does because it takes so much water from places. I mean, for instance, Robben Island, wasn't it? Was they planted that completely with eucalyptus trees, and then it became that desert, and then it was turned into a prison. So it played a very strange role in South Africa's history. But would you go around advising a country to get rid of its eucalyptus trees, for instance? I mean, when things have been put in the wrong place, what role could a botanic garden play in looking at that?
I think that obviously it depends on the situation, but we have got scientists working in places like Madagascar, where they are looking at planting there. I don't know about advising on policy around eucalyptus, but at least kind of raising the awareness. And to be honest, when we had that exhibition, not that many people knew of the kind of impact of eucalyptus around the world. We even had Americans who didn't know it came from Australia. People don't realize its story. So many people came in and recognized the smell, but they hadn't connected it to its kind
Well, it's very good in flower arrangements, I suppose, isn't it? Which is probably how a lot of people first see it.
You've got me thinking, actually, Rosie, because Robben Island, massive environmental destruction, became a famous prison. Saint
Yeah.
Helena, massive
Yes.
environmental destruction, became Napoleon's prison. There's probably a PhD in this, right?
There you go. There you go
It's
for someone out there.
the fascist's tree of choice, because
What?
it was used to drain the swamps in Italy,
Yes.
and Spain, and now it's a problem. So yes, it's a fascinating story, the story of eucalyptus.
So who first realized it could literally drain the swamp? That's such an amazing, I mean, I completely understand that, but I've just never heard that expression applied to the eucalyptus.
Yes, I don't know who first identified it,
Sorry.
but it was brought on the first fleet back from Australia to and planted at Kew, so it's part of Andrea's story around
How
banks.
much are you finding that you have to do work around climate change and adaptation at the moment with the plants where you're in the countries you work in?
It's absolutely the kind of primary focus
Mm.
for most of our work, I would say.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're sort of, I'm afraid, pretty much up to time. So I guess what would be nice to end on would be to ask you all how you see the role of botanic gardens in telling this, in what seems to be a hugely important part of our story, but also the world's story, because we're in such a global world where everything's moving around at top speed everywhere. Andrea, how do you see how botanic gardens can really help us in the future?
Well, I mean, I think, the obvious role is like scientific research, conservation, biodiversity. But when I hear an eminent writer about the empire say that he didn't know how important plants were when he started, then you think, there must be something terribly wrong with the storytelling in botanical garden. That, just as plantation houses in America had to adapt to, we have to tell the story of slavery also here, like in Mo Thomas Jefferson's Monticello, for example, then that should be part of the storytelling in a garden like Kew Gardens. And that we don't just look at plants as these are pretty plants, but these plants tell a story of politics, of exploitation and of the empire. And that's a very, very important story to tell, I think.
Absolutely. It's also an unbelievably interesting story, whichever way you look at it. I can't believe I got through all my school years knowing absolutely nothing about how rubber got smuggled out of Brazil. And, those stories, they're very exciting, in fact. They're every bit of exciting as, and obviously they led to a lot of wars, as Satnam said about the Malayan war after the war about the rubber. Satnam, how do you see the future of the botanic gardens?
I think the historic information they have, the archives, are going to be very important in the climate change debate. I feel like the conversation on climate change is changing to include colonialism, because I think people are now saying, okay, if you're going to lecture India and China on their emissions, let's think about what the British imperialists and the Belgian imperialists did in terms of the environment in the 19th century. That changes the argument. That information, I think, Kew Gardens and other botanic gardens will really be able to help with the conversation.
Yeah, it just gives us a lot more on our ledger, which we already have already. But I mean, it's absolutely true. If you look at the levels of, if we had not deforested the world in the way that we have, even if we'd gone and burnt the coal, we'd still be okay, because we've just taken away so much natural wonder. And Emma, you are the one who works in a botanic garden. Where do you see your future going with it?
Well, I think there is, we've captured it this evening. We've got this incredible kind of history. We're not a museum. We're a living, breathing, working organization, and all this complexity that we've talked about this evening kind of helps, I think, as we move into the future, needing to be more environmentally conscious and more aware of everything around us. And as you touched on first thing, the sort of health and well-being side of botanic gardens is becoming kind of increasingly important. And we noticed that during the pandemic, that we were a kind of a good space for people to come and enjoy and from there learn about these very difficult, challenging kind of stories and the plants in their garden and the legacies that are held within them.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. And I absolutely agree with you about, the more we learn about the benefits. I mean, I think it's going to be able to play a very big part in policy and urban planning in the future, the more science we can bring to bear on why we need to be near plants on a pretty consistent basis in order for well-being. But thank you so much to Satnam and Andrea and to Emma. We're going to be live in Kew in May on May the 8th. Do look out for the details because we're going to be doing a whole event about how you can use art to talk about the environment. And I've no doubt that the whole subject of everything we've talked about tonight will come in. Thank you very much for all your questions. I'm sorry, as ever, that we could only get to a few of them. Please buy our Andrea's and Satnam's books. They will not disappoint, I can guarantee. And thank you very much, as ever, for listening, and good night.
Thank you.